Hello, this is Stephanie.
And this is Brian.
Welcome to the making and the remaking of A Codependent Mind. In this episode, we're going to move on to chapter 5 of the book, The Fully Made Codependent Mind. It's the last chapter in part 1, and it's a shorter chapter.
Yeah, and because of that, we thought it would be valuable to add a little bonus feature to this particular reading and have a discussion about part 1 of the book.
Particularly what we learned during the writing of part 1.
Yeah, so this is kind of a little bit of a throwback style to season 4, episode 5, our anniversary, our 1-year anniversary episode, when we talked about the types of things we learned while doing the podcast, because we had learned so much of this stuff before we started the podcast, obviously, because that's what led us to believe we had something to share. But then in the process of doing all the research and having all the discussions and planning for the episodes, we learned all kinds of new things and we recounted that. And then the same thing has happened, fortunately, when writing the book. A whole bunch of new kind of angles and additional details fell out as we distilled this further.
So if you want to stick around after Brian reads chapter 5 for that discussion, we'll see you then. And here's Brian.
Chapter 5, The Fully Made Codependent Mind. I was in my mid-40s with 2 failed marriages, carrying the heaviest load I had ever carried of unresolved trauma, shame, fear, resentment, and sadness. I was in full self-preservation mode, ready to react the same way to perceived threats as I always had. I hadn't learned anything from those relationships. Why was I in those marriages? Why did I stay when things were so obviously bad? Could I even admit that they were bad? Why were those relationships so similar in so many ways? What did I really feel about each of them? What did I feel about myself? What did I really know about myself? What did I desire out of life? What did I expect out of relationships? What was it going to take to break my pattern? Even though I had spent decades avoiding my emotional signals, distorting them, and rationalizing them beyond recognition, the signals kept coming. Even though I had been betraying myself by doing things I didn't want to do and associating with people I didn't even like, my authentic side was still always there, however much in the background, waiting for the life it deserved. It was at this point that I met Stephanie. A vision of another life. Stephanie and I met in person at an event. We had an engaging first conversation. We were physically, emotionally, and intellectually attracted to each other. We kept in touch. We started dating and eventually fell in love. There was no love bombing, no moving in together within a few weeks, no rushing from one relationship milestone to the next. There was a genuine connection that deepened over time. It felt right, and it was right. Stephanie was looking for an emotionally intimate relationship. So was I, ultimately, but I had lost touch with what that even meant by the time we started dating. Emotional intimacy would quickly prove difficult for me to handle once we started down that road. I was carrying a lifetime of stories and narratives about myself and my life, along with everyone in it, past and present, and had no idea of how many holes, inconsistencies, and flat-out lies were buried in those stories. Jay still had access to me when Stephanie and I started dating. Not only had I not broken the trauma bond, she was still living in the house that I owned, and we were still going through our divorce. All of the new layers of shame that led me to ask for the divorce were still very fresh and at the surface. I was still very much afraid of Jay and what she might do if I made one wrong move, said one wrong thing. I was equally afraid of staring into the face of shame for too long. Stephanie started to notice some confusing behaviors. One minute I would be complaining about Jay and her treatment of me, the next I would be backpedaling and saying that things were mostly fine in that relationship. One minute I would be saying that I never wanted to speak to Jay again. The next, I was answering her phone call to console her and tell her everything was going to be all right. I could sometimes acknowledge that Jay wasn't a good person and was taking advantage of me, yet when push came to shove, I would bend over backwards to accommodate and support her. There were numerous people in my life who were telling me that I needed to kick her out and change the locks, but that suggestion did nothing but terrify me. Naturally, none of this was adding up for Stephanie. As she started to ask questions, everything only got more and more confusing for both of us. There was no consistency to my stories about my relationship with Jay. The more it came to light about what my relationship with Jay was really like, who she was as a person, the types of things I did while I was with her, how I treated those around me, like my family, the more difficult these exchanges between Stephanie and I started to get. At times, I would completely freeze and lose my ability to speak for a period of time. When I managed to emerge from that state, I would blurt out the first thing that came to mind in an attempt to diffuse the situation, to end the conversation. Sometimes I would tell flat-out lies. What was causing me to behave this way? Why was I responding with defensiveness to what was simply curiosity coming from someone I loved who was trying to get to know me emotionally? It didn't seem to line up with the person I thought I was or the person Stephanie had fallen in love with. It wasn't just bizarre, often hurtful exchanges or my struggle to make sense of my past that was causing problems. I seemed to lack intentionality much of the time. I acted as if things just happened to me. I struggled to articulate why I liked the things or people I liked and what I disliked. It often seemed as though I was just lining up, agreeing with everything, going along for the ride. I had difficulty explaining what I was feeling and how my feelings were connected to my actions. Things needed to change, and I knew they needed to change, but I had no idea where to start. I was devouring all of the emotional energy in the relationship. Stephanie was doing too much of the emotional labor, and it couldn't go on for much longer. But I desperately wanted this to work. I could feel at a profound level that I was where I was supposed to be. I just couldn't express it, and day after day, my ability to empathize would escape me. Another difficult conversation would start, and once again, I'd be going down a shame spiral. Despite my lack of self-awareness and my emotional immaturity, I did possess the willingness and motivation for growth. I was serious about getting to the bottom of these behaviors and committed to making regular efforts to figure out how to go about that. With consistent effort, I started to learn about myself and my past. Stephanie came across and suggested I read about the connection between codependency and narcissism. The realization that I was most likely codependent and that my previous partners, J and R, were most likely narcissists, led to a whole new level of understanding. As I explored that particular toxic link, so many things started to make sense. Even with that realization, the task before me seemed daunting. How was I going to get through all this? Was our relationship going to survive? There were times Stephanie wasn't sure that it would, and there were times that I wasn't either. But I wasn't about to give up. There had to be answers. There had to be a way to heal, to change these behaviors, whatever they were. I started to approach it as if my life depended on it, because in many ways, it did. And that concludes part one, chapter five of the book.
So again, next episode, we're going to be moving on to the remaking of A Codependent Mind. But let's talk a little bit about some of the major realizations that you had and that we had together as we talked about and wrote part one of this book. If you've been a listener of the podcast and you've now are listening to the book, you will probably have noticed some differences between the way that Brian talked about in the podcast, elements of his origin story, and the way that they're represented in the book.
I found this to be extremely helpful for me to fine-tune how I understand where my codependency came from. And the more I understand, I found the more complete picture I have when it comes to kind of resolving these behaviors and recognizing them, and also recognizing them in other people and within relationships and within different types of relationships. It's given me so much more tools to move through life, not just for myself, but for people around me too.
It really has been kind of fascinating how deep this well is. It was almost kind of this endless process of learning about yourself, which might sound negative, kind of, oh, I'm never going to be done. But it's actually been, I think for both of us, really kind of so exciting that there's always something to learn about yourself.
Right, right. And it's just, it gives me so much more relief to just understand this that much better every time we come up with one of these new twists.
And for me, it's I understand myself better as well. Like talking through what happened to you and figuring out the pieces of that has given me a lot of insight into my own past as well. So we hope that is true for others as well.
I'm hoping that this is just an inspiration. Right. I mean, like, it's one thing to for listeners to hear like, oh, okay, that's great that he found more stuff about his own story or whatever. But yeah, the point in us conveying this is stressing the importance of listeners doing that for their own story.
So let's get to it. We have, I guess, like two or three that really stand out.
The first one being, once again, the family of origin, right? Which is something we talked about in that episode in season four, anniversary episode, where, because it makes sense that I started with this kind of low-hanging fruit, this extreme friendship from my childhood, and thinking, okay, that's where the codependent behaviors came from, because it's just so blatant and obvious. But then we had this realization throughout the course of the podcast that, oh, actually, really, looking at the behaviors of my parents and my family atmosphere, it was really more that my codependent behaviors started right from day one.
Because you were four, almost five, when that friendship started. And, you know, zero to four are very formative years. So, we kind of realized you went into that friendship primed to get stuck in it. And if there hadn't been stuff that happened in your family, then one, you may never have gone in that friendship, or you may have found it easier to go get out of that friendship, or you may have even just felt you could talk to an adult or other people about what was happening in that. So, I mean, obviously there was a lot, we realized there must have been a lot going on in your family environment that kind of set you up for that particular relationship dynamic.
Yeah, because that's all I had, you know. I mean, I had little experiences outside of the house, but for the most part, 99% of my life was at my house with my family and my parents.
So what we went to next then was your father's behavior, particularly the way that his anger and his frustration and his outbursts affected you. That was the kind of next low-hanging fruit.
Yes, right. Yeah, it's the next layer up on the tree.
Yeah, that was, I mean, it was, you know, it was very vivid. You had vivid memories of it. It still happens. And it seemed, once we made that connection, it seemed pretty straightforward to understand how your codependent behavior was a reaction to his behavior.
And then how easy it was to make the parallel, the one-to-one connection of, oh, now I met this friend at school that was also angry. You know, I'm afraid of anger, and, you know, I'm already afraid of it. It's not that, like, oh, I'm encountering it for the first time and I'm forming codependency because of this five-year-old, you know, friendship when I'm four or five.
But with the book, and again, going back there again and really pushing ourselves and you really pushing yourself to remember and to think about that period of your life, we arrived at your mother.
Right. Yeah. And we talk about her a little bit in that family of origin episode. But looking back at the episode and the notes and everything, pretty much what I attributed to her was modeled behavior. You know, and that was there, of course. I mean, in a big way. Both of them, though, you know. I mean, but with her, the model behavior, that's basically what we said was that she modeled this powerlessness. She modeled codependent, compliant behavior towards my dad. Resentment. She modeled resentment as reaction to powerlessness. So yeah, those were huge things that rubbed off on me. But there was another whole layer that we left out, which is the fact that I was also trying to manage her emotions, which is a core codependent behavior. I felt responsible for her frustration, for her powerlessness, for her depression.
So a different set of emotions than what you had to manage with your dad. With him, it was the more what we kind of see as external, kind of the anger, the frustration, the impatience. With your mom, it was the more internalized, her depression, her disappointment, her discouragement.
Yeah, and they both made me feel unsafe in their own ways. So it was clear to me, I had so much to pull from as far as angry, abusive people, or even not abusive, but just angry, like my dad, people affecting me because of, you know, my fear response and codependent responses to try to appease the anger and all that. But there's other emotions that scared me. One being, yeah, my mom was my primary caregiver. And when she was not all there, she was had her own emotional difficulties going on. She wasn't the mother I needed her to be.
Yeah, which is very threatening to a small child. And, you know, particularly, you know, we were talking about this kind of 0 to 4, 0 to 3, which it's obviously it's hard to access those memories. Mm-hmm. But that behavior continues through all your childhood, much like your dad's. And so, and is present today. So we can assume that that was there.
Yeah. And I have plenty of clues. And also I have things she's told me about those days. So it's, you know, I can piece it together pretty well.
You know, assuming that people have listened, this is not about blaming
right. Either
of your parents or saying that they're bad people. You know, both of them, you have memories of them as loving parents.
Mm-hmm.
And your mom, even as a warm, giving mother,
yeah,
which, you know, might make it all the more scary when she would withdraw or when she would express emotions that didn't align with that.
Confusing. Yeah. Right.
So that whole piece was, really kind of interesting and to us. And, you know, I wonder if it resonates with other people, like how you really have to kind of dig into that childhood environment and get past the kind of surface happy childhood, had everything mm-hmm. I need sort of reaction and to see really kind of what was going on there.
And you don't need some kind of grand, you know, oh, my parents beat me and stuff like that. It doesn't have to be something like that.
Right. Those are the low hanging fruit ones.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
Obviously those would have had an effect, but the ones that are almost kind of disguised can be more insidious because it's harder to root them out. So realizing that was big.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it took some time. I mean, and repeated discussion and really kind of thinking together about what those effects might be. But that helped you understand the E relationship as well.
Yes.
Which is the kind of second big reimagining that happened during the book.
Right. So the E friendship, you know, we talked about that in the episode right before the Family of Origin one, the same season 4, I think episode 4.
I'll link these in the show notes so people can reference them if they're interested.
Yeah. So in that one, we kind of recounted how it was fortunate, if you want to put in air quotes, that I had some experience and how my codependent behaviors came out in a variety of relationship types, being healthy, being us,
mm-hmm.
To this kind of semi-healthy but destructive relationships with disordered people that weren't abusive, which is the friendship with E, all the way up to abusive people, the R and J relationships and things like that. But so then when we talked about that E friendship, I realized that I pretty much told the story that I had always told. It was kind of like I didn't update that story. So my story being, oh, we relied on each other too much. We formed a bubble. We held each other back. We, because it was like basically 10 years of isolation, you know, co-isolation. And I knew that much. And that part was easy. And then, you know, of course, how it ended, you know, him becoming more emotionally chaotic and unable to handle our situation.
And abusing substances to a greater degree.
Right.
A destructive degree.
Yeah. And so there was plenty there that I understood, but what I didn't understand, the big, huge thing that I left out was, and I looked back at the episode and the way I described it, and it's like, wow, that huge disconnect is that I said, well, but my codependent behaviors were pretty much not around.
They weren't activated.
They weren't activated. Right. That's how I put it. They weren't activated during that relationship. It was more my related behaviors, the compartmentalization, the emotional avoidance, resentment, a lot of resentment, you know, all these things where it was like my internalized behaviors, because I was thinking, oh, well, I don't think I really behaved codependently towards him.
With him, like, so the relationship itself, you thought were, you didn't see any evidence of codependent behaviors just in your larger life. And you say resentment, it wasn't resentment towards him particularly, it was resentment to the larger universe.
Yeah, the universe, other people for having success when I didn't, things like that. Or when people, because I had such a low image of myself, But then that whole thing where I had a low image myself, but if I detected that anyone else confirmed that image, I didn't like them for that.
Yes.
But yeah, writing the book and really, really, really spending more time digging into exactly how my codependent behaviors look across the board and have looked throughout my life, it was like, wait a second, no. I was very codependent. My behaviors towards him in that relationship.
Almost kind of classically codependent, yeah. Because he was someone, now we can say, kind of like your mom, uh-huh. Right? Who was struggling with what his life looked like and was struggling with depression and was struggling with disappointment. You know, for him, it was kind of career disappointment and romantic disappointment. And
yeah.
Your behaviors were almost kind of like codependent control that people get with people who are abusing substance or people who are chronically depressed. You try to manage it.
Right. And so not only did I miss that, I missed how actually destructive it was to that relationship and to him. Because...
Well, let's say counterproductive.
Yeah, sure. Right.
You were trying to help him.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I was trying to help him.
It wasn't like you were actively taking advantage of him. Like, say, no. Again, the narcissists were taking advantage of you. You were, in fact, doing things which many people would say, oh, that's great. Like, you were helping him financially. You were helping him house himself.
Yeah.
You were helping him.
But the motivation, you know, as we talk about in the book, and especially in part two, which is coming up, the motivation was off, mm-hmm. You know, so the main motivation for that was not empathy for him. The main motivation was fear. I didn't want to lose what we had. So this was the only safe relationship I ever had, intimate relationship that I ever had. And I didn't want things to change. So when he's expressing fear about his situation, I'm like, well, no, it's okay.
And like you say in the book, his distress and depression felt like a threat to you. Like your mom's depression.
Yeah, exactly like my mom's, yeah.
Felt like a threat to you. That would mean a withdrawal of this person that you cared about.
Yeah, so this was really valuable thing to flesh out because this is, like you said, going to be a more classic look at codependency for a lot of people. There's a lot of people that maybe don't necessarily get into a full-blown narcissistic abusive mm-hmm. relationship. They may be in a relationship just with someone else with a different type of disorder or another codependent person, something like that.
Right. Someone who's struggling and the other person's struggle, they take on the other person's struggle because mm-hmm. it's scary to them.
Yeah. And they're not really communicating with each other and they're not really self-aware of what they're doing and why they're doing it.
So yeah, like you say in the book, you wouldn't allow E to feel what he was feeling.
Yeah, right.
You would either try to manage it away or try to dismiss it. Try to explain to him why he shouldn't feel what he's feeling.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's just like, oh, don't worry about it. It'll be fine. There's so much of this. Don't worry about it. It'll be fine. We're working on what we need to work on. We'll get there. But also, yeah, curating it. So if he struggles, yeah, loses his job. Don't worry about it. I'll pick up the rent. Or he wants this music thing to happen, even though I didn't know myself well enough that I didn't want to do that for a living. But hey, I'm going to thrust my entire being into this to try to make it work across the board. Pretty much every behavior I did was codependent.
So that was another big one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the relationship with E, you know, you did some great work kind of reimagining those, re-understanding those, which was very helpful as we go into part two with the remaking.
Right.
To see how... You're still in the remaking process.
Yes, exactly, right.
That's the thing. I mean, a couple other minor ones too for me, or not minor, but certainly not as big revelations. I think we both came to understand even better this whole narcissism phenomena.
Oh, right.
So, I mean, I hope that chapter reflects an increased understanding of that as well.
And the connection to codependency and how similar it is and how a la carte mm-hmm. these behaviors can be.
Right. Well, and part of that, though, was identifying all the other people in your life who had narcissistic behaviors.
Oh, yeah. Right.
We focused, for obvious reasons, in the podcast and even in the book on R&J, but there were a number of friendships during your teenage years and just kind of people around you. So I couldn't... I think I've picked out maybe two people in my life who were really in my life in major ways that mm-hmm. I could identify as narcissists or that displayed narcissistic behavior, let's say. But they were just everywhere in your past. I know.
Right. So for you, it was probably, it was in situations where you really, you didn't choose the situation, right? I mean, it was like, what was it?
Right.
Job situations?
Yeah, job or friend of a friend. So saying, yeah, so a little bit of my life, but I mean, I didn't engage with them in a deep way because they were narcissistic.
Yeah. And so me, as we know now thoroughly from the podcast and the book, that they activated my behaviors and this is just, oh no, here we go again. I need to manage this person and this person needs to be managed and wants to be managed. And they have a hard time finding other people to do that. And they find a codependent person and here we go. And so, yeah, it happened to be in personal life, but it also happened in my professional life, but in a much more than it would have for you. Like some of my coworkers where I hear other people, other coworkers also have trouble with these particular coworkers, but then they just go, wow, I just don't talk to them or whatever. And just like, you know, there's ways to deal with it, even in the work environment. And I was just like, nope, I'm going to take this person's call every time and just let them unload on me.
Where's their BFF?
Yeah. So I think that's a pretty good sum up of the big takeaways we've had from part one of the book. And so now we're going to move on to part two of the book, starting with chapter 6 in a couple of weeks.
And like in part one, there is going to be some retread of some ground that was covered in the podcast, obviously, but there's also new things that you learned and that we learned together that make it into part two in terms of what were all the components that went into your healing process and how that played out.
Yeah. And I think quite a bit more, we go into more depth on the tools, kind of tools to things to look out for and things to actually do in response to learning about these behaviors and knowing that they're still here or whatever.
Because we understand more what you did.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And throughout writing the book, that's one of the things, you know, I mean, because writing is a big thing. And speaking of writing the book, I want to say thank you so much to those of you that have bought the book, have given us a review, have been listening to this, the readings. It just makes it so worthwhile to know that people are receiving this and enjoying it.
And the audiobook is now available on Amazon if you want to listen ahead, so to speak. And we hope you join us in a couple of weeks for part two, the remaking of A Codependent Mind.